Okay, so we're happy to have Matt, who will tell us more about cyber engineering.
Okay, thank you. So I'm picking up where Dave left off. So unfortunately, that means if you missed previous talks, that I can't go into much background about supersymmetry or things like that. So, and then the other disclaimer is that this is basically a physics talk. So, sorry. Before I get into some of the technical details, which
I should have said, Thor, that's better.
Well, anyway, you should make it clear so that you know what you're getting.
Yeah, yes. No apology.
Before I get into some of the technical details, which I'll have to compress a lot in order to talk about this in 1 hour, I just want to make sure that we're on the same page with the motivation for studying this theory, why its solution was so important in physics. So first of all, this is a theory. Whose low energy dynamics are exactly solved. Now, why is that interesting? So first of all, let me focus on this term low energy. Low energy might seem like some sort of restriction, that this is like maybe some not interesting regime to look at the theory, but that's actually not the case. I heard one physicist say that this is the basic question about every quantum field theory is to ask about its low energy behavior. Essentially, because the high energy theory, the microscopic theory, is telling you something about the laws of nature in some sense, and the low energy behavior is telling you about how macroscopic phenomena emerge out of those laws. So for an analogy, microscopic theory would be like Newton's laws, and then the low energy dynamics would be sort of the specific instances of celestial mechanics or something like that. So this is really telling us about how Seibert-Witten theory behaves at the scales relevant to macroscopic physics. Maybe not macroscopic in the sense of on our scale, but much longer scales than the strongly coupled gauge theory that lives in the UV. So that's why low energy is interesting. And then exactly solved is also very interesting because this is extremely rare in quantum field theory. So this is a theory, so-called strongly coupled gauge theory in four space-time dimensions. Now, exact solutions of quantum field theories in any space-time dimensions are somewhat rare. In four space-time dimensions, they're extremely rare. For gauge theories, they're very rare, and for strong coupling, they're almost non-existent. So the fact that you have an exact solution to a theory that has all of these adjectives in front of it is very remarkable. Another motivation is called electromagnetic duality. So electromagnetic duality has a long history in physics, starting with, the first studies of electricity in magnetism in the 1800s, you can observe that in Maxwell's equations in vacuum, so no matter sources, that they're essentially invariant under swapping the electric and magnetic field, but with a sign that I won't get into details about. So this is in a classical theory of an abelian gauge theory. And much more subtle is the question of, is there electromagnetic duality in non-abelian gauge theories at the quantum level? And this was a question that was pursued a lot in the 70s. And in general, the answer is typically no. So, except in special cases. So the N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory has an exact electromagnetic duality, probably. It's conjectured too. But theories with less supersymmetry, so this had 4 supercharges, such as the N equals 2 theory that we're considering today, the question is a little more subtle. The most naive thing that you could look for in terms of electromagnetic duality doesn't hold in theories with less than 4 supercharges. And that's essentially because the electric and magnetic particles have different spin. So I believe the matter multiplets in, for instance, the n=2 theory that contain electrically charged particles contain particles with spin up to 1, whereas the magnetic monopoles have spins up to 1/2. So you can't just switch those two things and expect to get the same answer back. But actually, we will find that, or Seiberg and Witten found, that a version of electromagnetic duality does hold in n=2 theories, and actually is what they rely heavily on to solve the theory. So. There's a version of electromagnetic duality in this theory, which is essentially, to give you a preview, that around points in moduli space, a moduli space that I'll define shortly, that are strongly coupled for the theory of photons and electric charges, you can come up with a dual description in terms of dual photons and magnetic monopoles, which is weakly coupled. But that's not an exact electromagnetic duality in the sense of n=4. But it's still very interesting, and that's why this is our second motivation for considering this theory.
Does it start by n=1 at all?
n=1 electromagnetic duality.
Well, n=0 has a duality.
Well, so n=0 with a abelian gauge group has an exact duality. The non-abelian theory is. It's more complicated. Generally, in the non-abelian theories, you have to introduce some sort of Higgsing in order to get monopoles at all. So I think Purion-Mills with a non-abelian gauge group doesn't have electromagnetic duality in any sense. But n=1, I'm not really sure.
I mean, there's Seiberg duality in n=1, but it's a different beast.
Right.
That's also for non-abelian.
Yeah.
But if somebody's talked about it, it's probably in these n=1 papers by Seiberg from the 80s. Another huge motivation is confinement. So for those with less physics background, confinement refers to a situation in gauge theories with matter, such as the actual theory that we use to describe strong nuclear physics, which is called quantum chromodynamics, or QCD, which is a theory of, we call them gluons, which are the gauge particles, and quarks, which are the matter particles. And essentially, the problem of confinement is that despite the microscopic theory having quarks in it, you don't actually see them at the macroscopic level. That's kind of the rough description. Maybe a more refined version of that statement is that quarks should experience a linear potential energy between them, or a constant force, such that if you try to pull them apart, essentially you can't. Now, the problem of confinement, which is one of the major outstanding problems of theoretical physics, is to actually argue from the microscopic theory, QCD, that quarks should satisfy this property of confinement, that they should have a linear potential energy between them. And that's not done in QCD to this day, but there are a number of ideas about how you might show that QCD is confining, or any other gauge theory. And one of them is called the dual superconductor model. So this is due to a number of people around approximately the same time in the 70s and early 80s. And the idea is to try to describe the gauge theory vacuum, in some sense, as behaving as an electromagnetic dual of a superconductor. So let me first say how a superconductor behaves so that this dual concept would be useful. So superconductors exhibit a phenomenon called the Meissner effect, which is that they screen magnetic fields. So kind of similar to how an electrical conductor doesn't want electric fields to penetrate into it, a superconductor tries to essentially realigns the constituents of itself such that it cancels magnetic fields that live in the body of it. So maybe I should draw a picture. So if this blob is some superconductor and you have an external magnetic field, it wants to bend the field lines around it to keep them out of it. Now, this isn't always possible, because if you are doing an experiment and you ramp up the magnetic field enough, eventually the superconductor is no longer capable of complete screening. But instead, what it will do is collimate field lines into thin tubes, often called vortices. Now, the reason this is relevant is, imagine if you had two particles in a dual medium, meaning I want a material, in quotes, because really there is no material. This is just the vacuum of a strongly coupled gauge theory that screens electric fields. And then I'll put color in parentheses, because for a non-abelian theory, you have several electric field directions, and so this is often called a color electric field. Now, if we had screening of color electric fields, and we had two color electric charges, so say this is a quark and an anti-quark, I have two pictures, actually. In general, without screening, if you have a charge and a charge of the opposite parity, you'll get field lines that look like this, that you might remember from an introductory class in electromagnetism. This is a Coulomb law type behavior. But if you have screening such that color electric field lines are forced into tubes, and the picture instead looks like this. So this is occurring over some distance d, and the cross section is constant as you move from the quark to the antiquark. And so from this, it's fairly easy to see that you get a linear potential as a function of the distance away from one of the quarks to the other. So the potential between these two will be proportional to d. So if you could argue that there is collimation of color electric flux, then that would presumably be a qualitative solution of the confinement problem. So another aspect of this that I need to tell you about, which is called monopole condensation. So a superconductor is characterized by the so-called condensation of electric charges. So in the microscopic theory of a superconductor, you have electrons. But in the superconducting phase, the correct variables to, or the correct objects to describe the superconductor in terms of, are actually bound states of electrons called Cooper. Now these bound states, E bar E, get a vacuum expectation value, and this is called condensation. So this in the superconductor would be condensation of electric charge. Now in the dual description, you would have magnetic monopoles, so magnetically charged particles, as the elementary constituents of the quote-unquote material, as opposed to electrons. And the onset of a dual superconducting phase would be characterized by the formation of essentially Cooper pairs of magnetic monopoles, which goes under the name of monopole condensation. So that was a lot. So let me try to summarize the reasoning. Essentially, the condensation of monopoles in a non-abelian gauge theory, condensation in the sense that operators like this get a vacuum expectation value, would tell you that you have the onset of a phase that looks like dual superconductivity, dual just referring to the fact that this is in terms of magnetic variables instead of electric ones. Dual superconductivity by a dual of this so-called Meissner effect tells you that you would have collimation of electric flux. And I argued earlier that collimation of electric flux would give rise to confinement. So, in one sentence, the idea is that monopole condensation is a potential mechanism for confinement in non-abelian gauge theories. The problem was that for many years, nobody had actually done a calculation that showed that this actually worked in a given non-abelian gauge theory. And one of the achievements of Seiberg-Witten is to show that there is monopole condensation in this n equals 2 super Young-Mills theory.
Well, I'm not confused about how many duals you are dualizing.
Yeah, sorry.
We want to be confined to quarks, right?
That's right.
So that like electrical thing.
Yeah.
So that means we should condense pair of quarks.
So maybe I'll make a so on the left, we'll have an actual superconductor, and on the right, we'll have the dual, which is the gauge theory. So the superconductor screens magnetic fields and therefore collimates magnetic fields. So we have magnetic flux tubes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Then over here, you have electric. Okay. Here, you have condensation of electric charges. Magnetic charges. Yeah. So I was flipping back and forth between the dual, between the superconductor and the dual a lot, but I'm not dualizing multiple times. I'm just jumping around. Sorry. So I should say that actually it's after a, they call it a suitable perturbation to an n equals 1 theory. So you add some sort of term to the action. It destroys the n equals 2 supersymmetry and using the n equals 1 theory in a natural way, they argue, in a natural way. It's actually in that theory that you have monopole condensation for as a mechanism for confinement. But I know that I won't get even near those subtleties, so that's all I'll say about that for now. the last motivation for numbering them, I think it's number four, is from math. And I won't be able to talk about this at all today in any detail, but the idea is that you can use these theories to compute invariants of smooth structures in four manifolds. So, Witten showed in the late 80s that a certain so-called topologically twisted version of N equals 2 gauge theory has as its correlation functions Donaldson invariants of the underlying spacetime. Now, this SU2 N equals 2 theory without the topological twist is exactly the theory whose solution we're talking about today. And in particular, one aspect of the solution is that in the low energy you have an abelian gauge theory. Now, if you do this topological twist procedure, that essentially destroys the distinction between high and low energy, because roughly the high and low energy are metric concepts, and the topological twist makes things independent of the metric structure. So you can actually compute topological invariants of the spacetime using the low energy theory, which is an abelian gauge theory. And so the PDEs that you have to solve involve abelian gauge fields and are much more analytically tractable, I guess, than the SU2 Yang-Gills equations. And the resulting objects are called the Seiberg-Witten invariants. And the connection to the Donaldson invariants is through the renormalization group from this SU2 gauge theory in the high energy to this abelian theory in the low energy. So that was a lot of motivation. I hope it was useful, though, for those of you who, if you don't get anything out of the technical stuff, you can at least leave with some ideas of why we care about Seiberg-Witten theory. So now we'll get to some more technical things. So let me briefly review the formulation of this theory in terms of the fields involved and the action and so on that Dave covered in detail over the last several lectures. So this is a theory of SU2 gauge fields and N equals 2 supersymmetry, so two supercharges, in essentially the minimal way that this is possible. So there's a single multiplet, a single gauge multiplet for N equals 2 supersymmetry. Vector multiplet, sometimes called N equals 2 chiral, which is very confusing, so I'll call it a vector. The N equals 2 vector has the following fields in it, and I'll arrange them according to their spin, so you can keep track of them. So there's a gauge field in the adjoint representation of SU2, so the I index goes from 1 to 3. You think of this as being, the gauge field is this in components times each of the Pauli matrices. There are two adjoint fermions, Weyl fermions, so lambda and psi, spin 1/2. And then there's an adjoint scalar. In terms of N equals 1 supersymmetry, these two form an N equals 1 vector multiplet. And these two form an N equals 1 chiral multiplet. Before I write down the action, the entire action, there's actually something that you can, there's some things you can learn with just a piece of the action. Namely, the potential for the scalar field. So finally, the scalar field is adjoint valued, so it's a matrix. And so this is its adjoint, and I take the commutator squared and the trace, and that's the scalar potential for phi. So we want to first ask about the space of classical vacua. Also called the classical moduli space. Call it MC for classical. So these are the constant fields, constant on spacetime, that are matrix valued and make the potential energy zero. So that condition just says that phi commutes with its adjoint, so it's diagonalizable, and then it has to be traceless because it's in the adjoint representation of SU2. And so what you get after using gauge transformations is that up to gauge equivalence, you have that a zero of the potential is of the form some number A, it's a complex number, times sigma 3. Sigma 3 is the third Pauli grade. So at A equals 0, have unbroken SU2 gauge symmetry. So you have some strongly coupled non-abelian gauge theory. But for other A, non-zero A, you have a Higgs mechanism, which is reducing the gauge group to an abelian one, just U1. I don't remember if you talked about gauge mechanisms, but unfortunately I have no time to.
Okay.
So essentially, the brief idea, if you haven't seen this concept before, is that by having a non-zero vacuum, essentially, so a trivial field would just be phi equals 0. By having a field of potential energy away from 0, you basically are getting rid of some of the gauge symmetry. And this is called the Higgs mechanism. I'll just say that for now. Now, there's a residual gauge symmetry which exchanges A and minus A. So actually, A is not a good gauge invariant coordinate on its own. A better thing to look at is what I'll call U, which is trace of phi squared. In terms of A, it's 2A squared. So our classical moduli space is the space of U's, basically. So U could just be any complex number, and then potentially we might want to allow it to be infinite. So our classical moduli space is the Riemann sphere, potentially with singularities, in a sense that I'll describe later, essentially metric singularities. So we're going to put some sort of metric on the Riemann sphere, and there will be singularities for that metric. And what the metric should be will come up in the field theory in a minute. So would say that this Higgs phenomenon reduces the gauge group to U1, the Abelian gauge group, but at low energies. So there's something that I left out, which is that it produces two new heavy particles, which correspond to the two dimensions, if you will, of SU2 that we lost in going to U1.
So I don't see why we have to have singularities. What's the reason?
Right. So in the, well, here's a heuristic physics argument in the classical moduli space, at least. When going from U equals zero, in which there's unbroken SU2 gauge symmetry, to U not equals zero, in which you have Higgsing, you acquire new massive particles, and you expect that to be some sort of discontinuous phenomenon. And that's a little weak, but that's a heuristic idea of why there would be a singularity at U equals zero. But the better reason is that we'll get the metric on the moduli space from the Lagrangian and observe that that metric has singularities, basically. Okay, right. So to talk about the singularities more precisely, I have to write something down about the action for the theory. So the Lagrangian, using the superspace formulation that Dave talked about, this is Lagrangian. Now let's remember what all of these things are. It's a lot of notation. So there's a function f, which is called the free potential. Which is, aside from singularities and branch cuts, is holomorphic. So essentially holomorphic in the sense that it depends on a complex variable but not the complex conjugate. This K is called a Kähler potential. And it's defined in terms of F by this formula. Tau is also some function defined in terms of F, again by taking some derivatives. And this is the complexified gauge coupling. So A, in the definition of Lagrangian, is defined by this relation. So essentially, phi was the n equals 1 chiral superfield, which is in the adjoint representation. And I just want to pull off the adjoint indices, basically, by pulling off the sigma 3. So the resulting A is also an n equals 1 chiral, but in a trivial representation, I guess, so no adjoint indices. And is that everything in these formulas? And then W is the vector one. So this is the gauge part. And then there were these superspace coordinates, which were the thetas, and there were four of them, and I have to, for the Kähler potential, I integrate over all of them, and for the gauge part, I only integrate over half of them. So to connect with formulas that are maybe a little more familiar, you have to write out the superfields in terms of component fields. And if you do that, then schematically you get that the action, or the Lagrangian, is up to factors. So you have the imaginary part of tau. Times a so-called nonlinear sigma model action for lowercase a, which is the scalar component of the superfield capital A. Plus the usual kinetic term for the Boolean gauge field. And then you have another term, which has the real part of tau multiplying what we would call a theta term for the gauge field. And then you have some other stuff. But this is all that's relevant for the current discussion. So this is telling you a few things. From the top line, the thing that usually multiplies the gauge kinetic term is 1 over the gauge coupling. So this is saying that the imaginary part of tau is like 1 over g squared, and g is the gauge coupling. And then the thing that multiplies this f wedge f term is usually called the theta angle. So the real part of tau is like the theta angle. And if you are more careful and put all the factors back in, you get the tau, which a priori depends on A, this lowercase a, is theta over pi plus so this A is a quantity essentially with dimensions of energy. And so it's behaving like a, so it's the vacuum expectation value of the scalar field, but it's behaving like a scale in the theory. So that's why in this renormalization group for tau, we're thinking of tau as depending on this scale A. Now, the last thing is that, so a nonlinear sigma model, which is this term here for A, takes its values in the moduli space of possible values for A, or space of vacua. And the thing multiplying, so I can't really, I won't derive this any further, but I'll just quote known things about these sigma models. The thing multiplying dA, dA bar, is interpreted as the metric on the moduli space that the field A is taking values in. So this is saying that the moduli space either classical or quantum, I suppose now we're considering the quantum case, is some complex curve with a metric on it, which in coordinates is the imaginary part of tau times dA, dA bar, and then potentially with singularity. So we said in the classical case that the moduli space should be the Riemann sphere potential of singularities. It will turn out that the topology isn't really changing. We're still getting the Riemann sphere, but with a different metric, different locations of singularities. And another argument for the existence of singularities is essentially that, so the sphere is compact manifold, If imaginary part of tau were a globally defined holomorphic function, of course it would take a minimum and a maximum somewhere. But it's a harmonic function, so by the maximum principle it would have to be constant, because the maximum can't be in the interior of the domain. So we would have the imaginary part of tau as constant. And we know from perturbation theory in physics, which is reliable for large A, that the imaginary part of tau is not constant. So that's another reason why there have to be some singularities. So let me quickly mention, we saw one feature of supersymmetric theories that has been heavily exploited. It's often called a holomorphy. So our theory essentially only depended on one input, which was this prepotential function f. And it had to be holomorphic away from singularities and branch paths. And so this is called holomorphy for supersymmetric theories. And the fact that it had to be holomorphic was essentially imposed by supersymmetry. And so this is a huge restriction on the allowed f's as opposed to theory without supersymmetry. And another feature of supersymmetric theories that has been heavily exploited is called non-renormalization or non-renormalization theorems, which essentially say that f has to have the following form. So this was known before Seiberg and Witten, that f had to be of this form. So I'll explain in a second what they did. It was new. F has to be of this kind of long form, but each of the pieces has a physical interpretation. So the first piece is called the classical part. This is what you would think would normally be the potential in kind of a standard quantum field theory of scalars, gauge fields, fermions, that gives cubic and quartic terms in the action. It's just this 1/2 tau naught a squared for some tau not constant. And essentially the reason is that I said that tau, the gauge coupling, was two derivatives of f. And so in the case that f is of this form, you just get back tau not. So the constant gauge coupling, which is the classical situation. The second term, some logarithm of the superfield divided by lambda. So lambda is called the dynamically generated scale. So this part is called the one loop term. It's computed using Feynman diagrams, perturbation theory, in which all the diagrams have one loop. And when you sum up all of these diagrams, you find that a certain function blows up at lambda. That's essentially the definition of lambda. And you call it a dynamically generated scale because it's a quantity with dimensions. It's not a unitless quantity. It has dimensions of energy. But it wasn't an input to the problem. It's coming out of the solution. And then normally in quantum field theory, you would have a two-loop term, a three-loop term, and so on. The non-renormalization theorems for these supersymmetric theories are saying that the only term coming from Feynman diagram perturbation theory is the one-loop term, and there are no higher directions.
That also has to do with the asymptotic freedom?
So the form of the one-loop term that I have here has to do with asymptotic freedom, but the fact that there are no higher loop terms, I don't think
it's so. Just the form, you know. It's a form.
Yeah, it's log over lambda thing.
That's predicted by asymptotic
freedom. Yeah.
But the vanish is something else. The vanish of the high.
Yeah, right. And then the last set of terms that you have an infinite series of negative powers of lambda, which are called instantons, or instanton corrections. So the physical objects are called instantons, and these are their contributions to the free potential. But there are some coefficients here that aren't determined. I call them CL. These are the only things in the formula that essentially are not determined. And there's infinitely many of them. So despite the fact that supersymmetry alone heavily constrained the form of the free potential, we still have infinitely many things that we don't know. So what Tyberg and Witten did is, essentially, you could phrase what they did is figure out what all of these CL should be.
Did you put the I the right place? Because it seems all imaginary except the first term. But they are not alternating. I'm expecting I is an exponent, so you get half real, half imaginary.
So what you are you saying?
Well,
you
the way you wrote
be,
it, except the first term, which is real, right? It's a free part, and then the rest is all imaginary.
Right.
I don't know the right formula, but I just curious. You know, it's like a half real, half imaginary, or is it all imaginary?
That's what they have here. I think. So it's supposed to be a holomorphic function, so it should be real sometimes and imaginary other times. I think that's the best explanation. I don't really know where the okay. factors are coming from, honestly. I should emphasize that finding an exact formula for F essentially constitutes an exact solution of the theory, because that was the only, F was the only input in the theory. Or alternatively, you could think about it in terms of the coupling constant as a function of energy. You get the coupling constant from some derivatives of F. So you get everything from finding what F is. Okay, so from the form of F, we can see that tau, which is two derivatives of F, will have monodromes. Monodromes in the sense of tau is a function on the Riemann sphere, and there will be singular points for which if you were to traverse the singular point one time around, you would have a transformation in tau, which is called a monodrome. And that's coming essentially from the log term. So after taking the derivative, you get some constants. And the log, again, now I'm writing things in terms of U, the moduli space variable, and stuff that's single value, the instanton parts. And if you wind around infinity in the Riemann sphere, the log shifts by 2 pi I, and so you get that tau goes to tau minus 4 under winding around infinity. So essentially what we're going to do is try to determine, we have some functions on the Riemann sphere with some singularities, and using formulas that we know, it's a physical input, we try to determine their monodromes around these singularities. And then the combination of the fact that the functions are holomorphic away from the singularities and we have known monodromes will allow, through some clever computations, the ability to exactly reconstruct the entire function. So that's the idea.
So before sample of Witten, did anybody compute some of the CL? I assume the low ones can be computed by some.
I think so. I think I think there were low-order instanton computations that Cyber Witten agreed with when it first came out. I think later, you know, there's this paper by Nekrasov with a lot of citations called Exact Cyber Pre-Potential from Instanton Counting or something like that. Or I think, I haven't actually looked at the paper, but from the title, my guess would be that he has some alternate instanton method for calculating all these things, and then it agrees with the cyber witness solution. So the singularities on the moduli space are crucial, from what I just described, for determining the exact solution of the theory. So let me go back to the discussion of the singularities. So we really have two moduli spaces. So there's the classical and the quantum moduli space. So the classical was just the, I defined this variable u, which was the vacuum expectation value of phi squared, basically. And we expected it to have a singularity at zero, because that was where you had a transition between Higgs and un-Higgs gauge groups. And also, you maybe expect one at infinity. Honestly, for reasons that I don't have the greatest handle on, so I'll just say that you might expect a singularity at infinity. Now, in the quantum moduli space, this was the space of classical vacua. So first, let me emphasize that the space of quantum vacua need not be the same. It could be rather different, actually. It could even have some topology change. In this case, they argue that it doesn't, but that the singularities, the metric singularities, are different than in the classical moduli space. So Seibring and Witten argue, and this is our thing to actually show. So essentially what they do is propose this and then give a number of consistency checks for why this is the right onsides. They propose that there are three singularities, one at infinity still, but actually the one at zero, which in the classical theory corresponded to the fact that you had gauge bosons becoming massless at u equals zero, actually splits and moves to plus lambda squared and minus lambda squared, where lambda is this dynamical scale that I had on the board a minute ago. Now, this is essentially the minimal choice, it turns out, is to have three singularities, one in infinity, and...
Matt, can I say a few words about the splitting? Because it seems, you know, it's kind of like a symmetry, I don't know, symmetry breaking or something. So it seems the quantum is more stable, right? You break the zero vacuum into two very small So their argument is just like this is the minimal. There must be a reason.
Essentially, I think so. The reason that the zero singularity goes away, they have some physical discussion involving conformal field theory in the IR, that if you had massless gauge bosons at zero, then in the quantum theory there would be some sort of operator. I think they say that trace, the thing that was defining u, trace phi squared, would be a conformal dimension zero operator. And the only one of those that should be around is the identity. For physical reasons, that this should not be the identity. And so I believe that was the reason why the zero singularity has to go away.
Okay, I think I also understand. Well, I don't understand, but I think it's where it comes from. You said this lambda is a dynamically generated scale.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a dynamically generated mass gap. And this lambda is the scale for the mass gap.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, so the mass gap is intimately related with so people call it dynamical mass generation or dynamical scale generation. It's very related. Yeah, that's right. So that was a heuristic reason why the zero goes away. Now, as far as why it has to split into two singularities, there's a u goes to minus u symmetry. whose origin I'm kind of forgetting, actually. Do you remember? That might have something to do with the R symmetry. But basically, whatever the reason, once you move away from zero, if you have a singularity now, you have to have minus that. So this is essentially minimal. And the consistency checks, or that if you assume this, for one, you get consistent monodromes for this function tau. Consistent in the sense that, I mean, potentially you could write down, I could say, oh, I want to find a holomorphic function on the Riemann sphere that has singularities here, 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 and here with this set of monodromes. And I guess potentially you might not find such a function. So the fact that you even do is to the credit of this proposal. With this choice, you get monopole condensation. Which, by the discussion earlier, was leading to confinement, which is expected on physical grounds, so this is good. And then I guess, I don't know that this is a reason per se. But with this proposal, you can actually get an exact solution for the prepotential. Whereas, I suppose, for others, you might not be able to solve this monodromy problem. And then, as you point out with the instantons, you would want to check that low orders instanton computations agree with what you get from this, and they do. So there are a lot of reasons why this is a good proposal, but it's a very hard thing to prove in any sense. So, just like the singularity in the classical moduli space at u equals zero was coming from some particles becoming massless, the singularities in the quantum moduli space are also coming from certain particles becoming massless. Kind of sketch this conformal field theory argument that it shouldn't be gauge bosons that become massless. And so what else is there? Well, essentially the only thing else that there is are monopoles, magnetic monopoles, and dions. So a dion is just the name of a particle that has electric and magnetic charge. So the proposal is that at equals lambda squared that you have a magnetic charge 1, electric charge 0, monopole that's becoming massless. And at minus lambda squared, have a it's 1 minus 1. Might have flipped those. A particle with magnetic charge 1 and electric charge minus 1. It's becoming massless. Now, I still haven't said anything about electromagnetic duality, so let me do that.
Are you aware of the time value? There's no clock in the room anymore.
Let me see.
What time is it?
Oh, okay. So I should probably wrap up.
You can keep going for a while, but just, you know, not another hour.
Right.
I don't mind another hour, but I'd rather people do.
Now, in supersymmetric theories, in theories with extended supersymmetry, so n equals 2 theory, even higher, there's a connection between, let's see, confidentiality. And the masses of dions, so particles with electric and negative charge. So essentially the relation is this: the supersymmetry algebra central charge, which I'll write down in a minute, is for a dion of electric charge NE and magnetic charge NM, is NE times A, where A was this parameter related to U earlier, and AD is a dual parameter. Derivative of the free potential with respect to A. And then the central charge itself, I should say what that is that if I have a theory with two supercharges, I can ask what the anti-commutator between them is. Let me actually say I have multiple supercharges. And it has to be proportional to the identity matrix with some proportionality constant called Z, which is the central Suzy central charge. So this is already a fairly amazing relation in that it relates the supersymmetry algebra central charge to the electric and magnetic charges of the objects. And then we have a relation to the mass of these dions, which is called the BPS bound. Which is that the mass squared of a dion has to be greater or equal to the z squared. So essentially, we can find out where dions become massless, m equals 0, by looking at where z equals 0. So finding solutions of this equation. And these correspond to the singularity. And so, for instance, for the choice NE equals 0, this term drops, and you have magnetic charge 1, so you find that AD has to equal 0. So that's one of the singularities in moduli space. A, so I should, just to be clear, A and AD are functions of the moduli space variable U, coordinate U. And the singularity corresponding to a magnetic monopole becoming massless is the point U for which AD equals 0, and that's this lambda squared. So the monodromes that we'd like to use to compute the prepotential are the ones of A and AD on moduli space. And potentially, if we know these, then we can reconstruct A and AD, and then from them we can get back the prepotential, or I'll just write the coupling, that's just as good. If we can figure out what A and AD are, then we can get the exact gauge coupling. Now, the way to figure out what the monodromes are was from the essentially perturbation theory. So for instance, at U equals infinity, you can use the one loop formula that I wrote down earlier to find that A and the dual of A, so A was like a Higgs field and A dual is a dual Higgs field, that they have to have this asymptotic behavior around U equals infinity. And similarly, you could write down for U equals plus or minus lambda squared, the other two singularities, you have similar formulas. And so now the idea is to use these formulas combined with the fact that these are holomorphic functions to determine A and AD. And that's something that I will not go into for time and also lack of full understanding. But essentially what they do is they solve it by for each U in moduli space by writing down an elliptic curve. So U is a fixed element of moduli space, and for each U you get a curve. So notice the lambda squared minus lambda squared, and then we have U. So the curve becomes singular if and only if U is plus lambda squared, minus lambda squared, or infinity. And essentially you use the periods of certain meromorphic forms around this curves, around this non-trivial homology cycles in this curve to determine what A and AD are. So A and AD are periods of some form around non-trivial homology cycles of the torus, gamma 1 and gamma 2, and then the form, I'll just write it down for concreteness. I'll have to define a number of other things in order to write it down, so maybe I'll skip that. But the point is that this is essentially just a clever technique for solving this problem of finding functions that have this asymptotic behavior at these three singular points, is to write them as periods. But this is very pretty, but I don't want to let it obscure the purpose. We just wanted to know what these two functions were, because from them we get the exact gauge coupling as a function of the moduli space parameter, which is like an energy scale. And from that you can integrate to get the prepotential, and that's the exact solution of the theory. So just to recap quickly, and that'll be done, we can find the exact solution of this theory in the sense of finding the coupling and the prepotential, the exact solution of a strongly coupled gauge theory in four dimensions that exhibits confinement through monopole condensation and has interesting connections to four manifold invariants, and hopefully could relate to the gauge theories of our actual world through some sort of supersymmetry breaking that we don't yet understand. That's the future. So I'll stop here and take questions if there are any.
So when you said there's some conformal field theory, I assume you mean a 1 plus 1 conformal field theory of a two sphere. Is that true? Or is there some other conformal field theory?
Let me see. 3 plus 1.
So the question was whether one of the singularities was due to gauge bosons, the fundamental gauge bosons becoming massless. And the argument is that if they became massless somewhere, then you would expect a conformal field theory in the infrared. So a 3 plus 1 conformal field theory.
Okay.
For which this trace phi squared would have to be the identity, but it shouldn't be the identity. So that was the reasoning.
Then other people...
If you put in 4 flavors, you get a conformal field theory.
Oh, okay.
But if you put in if you have no flavors, which is the first case they did,
okay,
then it's not conformal.
So this function, I think an FA or something,
mm-hmm,
it has a connection with like a conformal block or something in 1 plus 1 conformal field theory. It looks like some kind of a function. That's why I asked for 1 plus 1.
Right.
You know,
you mean just because the script F?
Well, yeah, just, well, it looks like some kind of logarithmic conformal field theory. You know, there's a pole, there's a regular part, and, you know, it just... Anyway, I don't know. I'm just curious.
I don't know. I know that there are connections to conformal field theory from some of this electromagnetic duality stuff. Like, I think from the same year, 94, there's a paper by Waffle-Witten on N equals 4 theory that has some connection to 1 plus 1 CFT, but I don't know if it's through any kind of prepotential or something like that. Actually, I guess there is no prepotential.
So we said that the imaginary part of tau is the metric on the moduli space.
Mm-hmm.
But that interpretation requires that the imaginary part of tau be positive. How do we know such a thing is guaranteed?
Yeah. So the clever bit about this curve stuff was to show that tau is the shape parameter of the torus corresponding to this elliptic curve, which would have to manifestly be in the upper half plane. So that was the idea. But there's some sort of theorem that's being implicitly relied on there. It's probably due to Riemann or something. But
I thought Dave mentioned this point when he was talking.
Well, I mentioned the tau had to be positive.
But
I don't remember if I gave a reason.
I think you did mention, but I forgot if you gave a reason or not.
So that's essentially that it's the shape parameter of a torus. But I think there might be some more subtleties buried in that statement.
Yeah, it's amazing how hard this theory is. I was in Princeton talking with Zeinberg. I said, I just cannot understand. He said that you just don't have the right background to understand the theory completely.
Yeah. Well, the supersymmetry is very technically complicated.
Yeah,
that's why I tried to avoid actually using many of the formulas on the board. But
I mean, somehow the goal of the whole special year in 95-96, 96 to 97, was to get some group of mathematicians to understand this formula.
I don't think we much for a success.
No.
I'm still working on it. Actually, that's the most impressive time, you know.
Yeah.
I remember that I was a foreman of a topology. I saw those, you know, email news like every on a daily basis, you know.
Yeah.
Here's the foreman of a question. We
even
were so
an,
hard.
Even on an hourly basis.
Yeah, basically, like, this is considering, you know, you would be famous, you know, if you saw one.
Right.
Before Cyber Committee, and now just for, like, by hourly.
Right.
So beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I know I just gave a talk about it, but I still don't fully understand. Which, if I had to talk for 4 more hours or something, it would start becoming quickly apparent. But yeah, it's very complicated.
Maybe we should do it again when I have you with our learn more of something. I really like how style is going to be better.
Okay.
In the future.
Sometime.
Yeah.
I don't know when. All right, let's thank Matt again.
I will be here if you want to talk.